Thousands and thousands of people rallied for a second day across Myanmar Sunday, denouncing last week's coup. Protesters are also demanding the release of elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi in the biggest protest since the 2007 Saffron Revolution that helped lead to democratic reforms. On Sunday afternoon, the junta ended a day-long blockade of the internet that had further inflamed anger since the coup last Monday. There was no comment from the junta, and state-run television news carried no mention of the protests. 12 members of Somalia's security forces were killed and two others wounded on Sunday. The deaths following a powerful roadside explosion in the central state of Galmudug, according to officials. The attack occurred near the village of Eldere, 28 kilometers west of Dusamareb, during a security operation, according to those officials. Dusamareb is about 510 kilometers north of Mogadishu. The Al-Shabaab militant group claimed responsibility. Officials say as many as 150 people are feared dead after a large piece of a Himalayan glacier in northern India broke off and slammed into a dam early Sunday. The disaster is flooding the Dauli Ganga River and forcing the evacuation of downstream villages. Authorities say at least 9 bodies have been recovered in the unfolding incident. Prime Minister Narendra Modi posted on Twitter, "India stands with Uttarakhand and the nation prays for everyone's safety there." One resident who lives in one of the villages said in a Reuters interview that the flooding came very fast and there was no time to alert anyone. This is VOA News. Speaking Sunday in an interview with the media network CNN, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said American workers who earn $60,000 per year should receive stimulus checks as part of the White House's proposed coronavirus relief package. The White House has said it is open to negotiation on who should be eligible to receive the proposed $1,400 checks and has declined to specify where it thinks the income cutoff should be. If Congress approves the $1.9 trillion plan, Yellen said the country would get back to full employment next year. Otherwise, she said, unemployment would linger for years. Republicans on Capitol Hill have resisted the administration's COVID-19 relief plan, concerned it would unnecessarily increase the national debt following the $4 trillion aid Congress passed last year. The U.S. Senate will soon have to decide whether to convict former President Donald Trump for incitement of insurrection. The former president's impeachment trial begins on Tuesday, the first for a president who is no longer in office. Senators will sit at their desks and listen to hours of testimony about the violent mob of Trump supporters who laid siege to the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. The House impeached President Trump on January 13th, 1 week after the violence. Republicans and President Trump's lawyers argue that the trial is unnecessary and even unconstitutional because he is no longer the president and cannot be removed from office. While his acquittal is expected, all 100 senators will first have to sit at their desks and listen to hours of graphic testimony from House Democrats. Ecuadorians choose a new president on Sunday. Many voters are weary of painful economic austerity measures and eager for a return to socialism, encouraging left-wing candidate Andres Arauz, who hopes to win without needing a runoff vote. The 36-year-old economist, a protege of former President Rafael Correa, leads in polls on promises to make $1 billion in direct cash payments to families. His main rival, Guillermo Lasso, has been hurt by his image as a conservative banker, and pollsters say the possibility of low voter turnout due to the pandemic could dent his support. The Biden administration said on Saturday it was immediately suspending Trump-era asylum agreements with El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. The announcement is part of a bid to undo his Republican predecessor's hardline immigration policies. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka. VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, via Skype, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas, and our moderator is Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Joe Biden has been busy as 46th president of the United States, issuing a series of executive orders meant to reverse some of the key policies of the man he defeated in the last election, Donald Trump. And the United States Senate is about to put Mr. Trump on trial, an impeachment trial, even though the accused is no longer president and he won't be at the trial. The coronavirus crisis, the number of deaths per day here in the United States, has been declining a little, as well as the number of COVID-19 victims being treated in hospitals. But there's huge concern about variants or mutations of COVID-19. Officials admit they have to find a way to speed up the process of vaccinating Americans to protect them from this virus. And other major news in the past week or so. Let's begin with President Biden. He has said he wants to be bipartisan, meaning he, as a Democrat, would work with Republicans. He met with 10 Republican senators in the White House, but President Biden says on his top priorities, including $1.9 trillion he wants Congress to approve to fight COVID-19 and to help boost the U.S. economy, he will push for passage, even if it's only by Democrats. Josh Glancy, with all the bitter divisions in U.S. politics, is Mr. Biden really trying to be bipartisan?
Yeah, that's the great question at the moment, isn't it? I think in his heart of hearts, he does really want to be bipartisan. But at the same time, this coronavirus relief bill is urgently needed. And I think there's a real sense that they need to use their momentum out the gate. As president, you know, in the first 100 days, there's always a time when you want to get a lot done. The country needs the money. And the economy needs the money. And so I think there is a genuine desire for bipartisanship, particularly from the top, from President Biden. But at the same time, they're not willing to get dragged down into the trenches and take too long to get this bill passed or to sacrifice too much of it. There has been an offer from 10 Republican senators, and they are working with the president. There was a long meeting in the Oval Office. You know, these are people that Biden knows well from his time in the Senate. These are the kinds of deals that he spent his career working on and hammering out. There is the possibility for some kind of consensual compromise, but I wouldn't necessarily hold out too much hope. As I said, they're very keen to get this through very fast, and they want it to be big, and they feel like compromising it is compromising what the American people need. That's the sense that Democrats have around this. It's definitely up in the air whether we'll see any real compromise.
Well, politics is usually the art of compromise, but one wonders about the past 4 years. Everything was so bitter and difficult. Abdulrahim Fukara, what's your view? Do you think Joe Biden, above all, is trying to reverse what Donald Trump did during his term?
There are strong indicators that he is. Many of the executive orders that he has signed seem to go in that direction. Ultimately, the executive orders would have to percolate through Congress in one way or another at some point or other. And that will bring us back to the issue of bipartisanship, how much he can successfully push through Congress. I wanted to say that given the contentious election that the country has gone through, but in particular, given what happened on the 6th of January with the storming of Congress, one would have expected a greater sense of urgency on the sides of both parties to work together. After all, it takes two to tango. But the country is not there. It seems that, you know, the divide is as sharp as ever today, even when Joe Biden is trying to draw attention to the urgency of the stimulus package that he wants Congress to deal with. And if I may also add, the issue of bipartisanship, the fact that he is accused now by Republicans, Joe Biden, that is, of not actually being genuine about bipartisanship. It seems to me that in the world we live in today, post January the 6th, there is a big difference between bipartisanship in Congress and uniting Americans. The two parties may be divided in Congress about a whole host of issues. They may not even find a bridge to bipartisanship. But it could be his calculus, Joe Biden's calculus, that moving beyond the legislation in Congress, if he manages to get the stimulus package passed by Congress, even by a slim Democratic majority, ultimately the aid that he wants to offer to Americans, it reaches left, right, and center, including the supporters of Donald Trump. I don't know ultimately if that is his calculation, but all I'm saying is that in today's world post January the 6th, there may be a difference between wanting to unite Americans and wanting to be bipartisan in Congress.
One thought when it comes to uniting the country is whether Joe Biden will choose issues where he thinks there could be a national consensus. But on the other hand, this past Tuesday, he was working on the subject of illegal immigration and basically by signing some orders which give the United States a much softer policy toward people entering this country from Latin America, typically without visas. For instance, he ordered that efforts be made to reunite children, apparently thousands, who were separated from their parents. They had crossed in from Mexico. The parents typically were arrested and then expelled from the US. The kids were held separately. And so the Biden White House thinks this is a humanitarian issue that everyone would get behind. But as soon as you talk about immigration, it tends to be divisive, Josh.
Well, I think the issue of child reunification is not divisive. You know, that was one of the worst policies really of the Trump era. It was badly executed. And it was badly responded to in the sense that they didn't properly go to the ends of the earth to reunify children with their families, which is not acceptable. So I think it's really important that Biden's getting behind that. And whatever children haven't been unified with their families hopefully will be. And that's, you know, a nice feel-good win for them as well. On the broader issue of immigration, yes, that is likely to be quite divisive, particularly they're opening up a path to citizenship for something like 11 million illegal immigrants currently in America. There will be a lot of people who oppose that, but they lost the elections. And unfortunately, we're in this situation now in America where instead of trying to pass a comprehensive immigration bill through Congress, which is what the country needs, really, that takes into account lots of different interest groups, presidents are ruling by executive fiat here. Trump did it with his wall, with his child separation stuff, with his Muslim ban. And Joe Biden is now doing the same, which may satisfy Democrats in the short term, but it doesn't resolve any of the long-term issues. And it means that the next president can equally undo his work. So it's a bit of a sort of pendulum politics, really.
There's also the issue of whether to punish Donald Trump, the only president in U.S. history to be impeached twice by the House of Representatives. Before he left office on January 20th, the House of Representatives voted to impeach Mr. Trump for a second time on a charge that he had incited the violence inside the Capitol building on January 6th. Pro-Trump rioters who insisted their hero was defeated in the election because of cheating invaded the Capitol. At least five people died, including one police officer beaten to death. This past Tuesday, Officer Brian Sicknick's remains were brought to the famous rotunda of the Capitol building under the famous dome, lying in honor, saluted by police, by members of Congress, by staff members, in effect thanking police for protecting them on January 6th. President Biden and his wife Jill came and stood briefly in silence. Normally, after a president is impeached by the House, the U.S. Constitution calls on the Senate to hold a trial, even if the president has left office. This has never happened before, but just about everything about Donald Trump defies conventional history. And yet the usual punishment, removing a president from office, is irrelevant. It's moot. He's already out. Abdurrahim?
In working my way to that, to offer a thought on what Josh said just a little while ago about pendulum politics, because pendulum politics is not just a huge problem for Americans internally. It's also a huge problem externally. I mean, you have the rest of the world watching now. Successive American presidents come and change U.S. policy. You had, for example, Trump. He came and he tore apart the nuclear deal with Iran. And now Biden is trying to reroute back to it in one way or another. And then you have these executive orders which Biden has signed, and the whole world will be wondering, will they stand or will the next U.S. president cancel them? So that's one level of it. The other level is what happens to Donald Trump. think that the whole thing about bipartisanship and uniting Americans that we're talking about, it has a time tag to it, because Donald Trump is no longer the U.S. president, obviously, but he is now trying to consolidate his influence inside the United States by consolidating his influence over the Republican Party. And that would obviously pose a huge problem for the American political system, but also for Joe Biden. And we're already seeing this in Congress, whether it's about the impeachment of Donald Trump, which looks unlikely to yield the result that the Democrats want, or the controversy about Liz Cheney, who had supported the impeachment, although she is a Republican, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who seems to hold conspiracy theories and is strongly supported by Donald Trump, who is pushing the Republicans to support her as well. So there's a very strange concoction of political stuff going on now in the United States.
The Biden White House doesn't want to make it appear as though the president wants to punish his predecessor. That would be a bad look for the United States. But Democrats in the United States Senate are hoping that in the impeachment trial, they might at least win a vote to ban Donald Trump from ever again running for public office. There's a lot more to discuss here on Issues in the News after this brief break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas, and our moderator, Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
The coronavirus crisis has become a kind of race in many countries, including here in the United States. COVID-19 keeps spreading, but vaccines have been invented and are being distributed. The Biden administration does seem frustrated that the pace of administering the vaccines has been slower than officials had hoped. The 50 individual states were allowed to make their own plans, so there hasn't been a clear national vaccination program. Abdulrahim, does this look like a failure so far? Or perhaps we should mostly appreciate the almost miraculous work by scientists that produced vaccines. At least they've been invented.
I think scientists have done a tremendous job to get this country and other countries around the world to where they are today. But since we're talking about the United States, when you recall the amount of time that it took the US to come up with vaccines throughout the history of vaccines, and you compare that with the speed with which vaccines for the coronavirus have been produced, obviously there's tremendous credit in that to US scientists. But to be fair, for all his failings, there's also maybe some credit to be given to Donald Trump, because he may have failed the country in terms of helping it prevent the kind of dizzying spread of the coronavirus throughout the months. But he also pushed very hard to get vaccines. Biden has made pledges to be more efficient in dealing with the virus situation in the United States and the vaccines. And as we've heard from Dr. Fauci recently, the country needs to be vaccinated. 85% of the country, he said, needs to be vaccinated before you can say it's all under control. Up to this point in time, according to Fauci again, only 2% of the U.S. population has been vaccinated. So that gives you a sense of both the hope, but also the challenges awaiting the Biden administration.
Dr. Tony Fauci was talking about the need to vaccinate, as you say, about 85% of Americans in order to return to normal day-to-day life. Americans are already thinking about when will they go back to their workplaces and to theaters, cinemas, sports stadiums. Seems a long way off. And Josh, we combine that with reports that there are still parts of the American population who don't believe in vaccines or don't believe that these vaccines are safe. In other words, Americans who may refuse ever to get the shot or the jab.
Yeah, certainly the somewhat chimeric goal of herd immunity, this idea that we're going to really have the population fully inoculated from the virus, does seem ambitious, certainly this year. I think there's a race of vaccines against variants. We've seen different mutations of the virus coming out of South Africa, Brazil, England, which are going to potentially make it harder for some of the vaccines to work, although not impossible, it seems. Certainly, you do have some anti-vax sentiment. It's been notable even among people working in care homes, among even nurses, that some people haven't been confident about the vaccines or confident in their relationship to American medicine to take the vaccine. This is going to be a long haul. You know, some people are talking 2, 3, 4 years now. That isn't to sound too downcast. America is vaccinating now at about 1.5 million a day. Hopefully it can accelerate beyond that. A lot of people will be immune to this virus soon, and a lot of people will have their lives saved by these vaccines. It's not going to be perfect. It's going to be messy. It's going to take a long time. At the beginning of this pandemic, we all hoped there would be an end date and we could all go and have a big party and get on with our lives. I think we've all come to see that that's not how this ends. But, you know, we have vaccines. We can adapt these vaccines to new variants. It is a long, messy fight ahead of us, but we have the tools to win it. And so I think we can all take some heart from that.
Many officials of the Biden administration say that economic recovery depends on beating the coronavirus, and that's why, well, frankly, that would take time. But in the meantime, the president is forming his cabinet. The U.S. Senate has voted to confirm some of the key nominees. So now we have a new Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. He's a longtime advisor to Joe Biden. Blinken had senior jobs also in the Barack Obama administration. And he's considering changes to U.S. foreign policy, for instance, on Iran. The president and Secretary Blinken would like to find a way to re-enter the nuclear accord that was reached in 2015. President Trump left that deal in 2018. We'll see if any talks with Iran will happen. On the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, the State Department said that the U.S. will oppose Israel's expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank, a land captured by Israel in 1967. The Trump administration was never critical of Israel on that issue. Also, the U.S. will oppose, it says, any Palestinian encouragement of violence, including payments made to the families of alleged terrorists captured or killed by Israel. Abdurrahim, there seems to be a move here to make U.S. policy, for instance, in the Middle East, more even-handed and to move away from the way Trump approached these issues.
Well, absolutely. And that takes me back to Josh's earlier point about pendulum politics. I mean, a lot of the policies pursued by the Trump administration, you mentioned two of them, Iran and Israel-Palestine, they are now under scrutiny by the Biden administration with a view to actually changing them. To what extent or how much of those policies the Biden administration will be able or willing to change? Obviously, there are indications that in the case of Israelis and Palestinians, for example, the embassy in Jerusalem will stay, the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem will stay in Jerusalem. Biden is not niggling about that. So in the case of Iran, the hurdles for going back to an accord are enormous. They're staggering. There's obviously opposition from the Israelis. There's opposition from the Saudis. There are a lot of concerns, not just about the nuclear deal. There are a lot of concerns here in Washington and in other capitals in the Middle East about Iran's influence throughout the Middle East. Nonetheless, Biden wants to go back to some sort of understanding with the Iranians. At the end of the day, even if he reaches an agreement, unless he can get the Senate to adopt it as a treaty, we could be back to pendulum politics, another president reneging on any agreement that Biden may achieve with the Iranians down the road.
As for U.S. relations with other so-called great powers, so far it seems the Biden administration is taking a hard line toward China, emphasizing human rights more than the Trump administration generally did. In Southeast Asia, when the military seized power in Myanmar, the U.S. government condemned the coup and demanded that the Nobel Peace Prize winner, the elected leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, be released from detention. That was a quick and strong stand that, again, I don't think Donald Trump would have intervened, but the Biden administration is showing a return to the old concerns about human rights around the world. Josh Glancy, what's your take on that?
The question really around this is, you've seen a change of language, undoubtedly and expectedly. We're talking the language of human rights again. We're talking the language of, you know, America as a liberal humanitarian superpower that will seek to promote those values all over the world and push back against authoritarianism. But are they actually going to do much to follow through on that? You know, can they do much? Trump, in some ways, didn't care, but he was also something of an arch pragmatist, if you like, when it came to foreign policy, in that he didn't think that America could do much or had any business to do much in places like Myanmar. So it's good to see Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, restating America's commitment to promoting human rights. But in reality, how much can they do? I mean, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi was imprisoned in her house for many years until recently by the military in Burma and in Myanmar, sorry, and she may well be again. There is a distinction here between language and reality. And the reality is the Biden administration is dealing with the same world and the same set of powers and the same balance of power that the Trump administration was. How much they can really change that, particularly when it comes to superpowers like Russia or China, is up for debate, I think. And I think they are learning the limitations of that as they come into power.
Let's talk about some strange trading on American stock exchanges. The equity or shares of companies that had no reason to suddenly go way up soared in value. The movie theater chain AMC, BlackBerry, above all, the video game shops called GameStop. It seems that often at 4 o'clock in the morning, conferring online on messaging boards, investors, we think of them as small investors, discover that by acting together, buying the shares and options, they could force large investment groups known as hedge funds to give up their negative positions on those stocks, and then the stocks would go up. Hedge funds, in fact, lost billions of dollars. Some of the so-called little guys made millions. But Abdelrahim, the reputation of America's stock market has been damaged. Would you agree?
I would. It's like in U.S. politics that we were talking about a little while ago. I mean, you get these crazy fluctuations over a very short period of time at the stock exchange, and you have a rush of people described as regular Americans trying to buy GameStop shares, and then to have the shares actually plummet, and then to regain a little bit more strength again, and then to plummet again, leaving those millions of supposedly ordinary Americans in the lurch at a time when they, in particular, as ordinary Americans, need all the help that they can get with the economic situation and the pandemic. Americans, as you know, are divided in trying to understand exactly what happened. I've seen theories that ordinary American movements harking back to the Occupy Wall Street are basically trying to bring down the system of Wall Street as dominated by big money.
Josh, I felt that those little guys getting together without apparently old-fashioned financial experts, it was kind of a populist movement, like a mob deciding to do some damage to the large establishment investors, also hoping to make some money and I guess maybe have some fun. How did you see it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that was one aspect of it. Another aspect of it was that there are some pretty smart investors out there who did also get together and back GameStop and then pull out when the profits were highest. And a lot of people that lost money in this were ordinary people stuck at home during the pandemic, maybe playing around with their stimulus checks or whatever. It's dangerous to trade on a volatile stock like that. Although it looks populist, it's kind of a meme populism, if you like. It's an internet populism. It comes and it goes. It's evanescent. It doesn't last very long. And I think some real people did get hurt. And I think that it's not really a realistic way of reforming the financial system, of addressing economic inequality in America. I think a lot of people just found it quite emotionally satisfying to see the big boy hedge funders get a kicking. But long term, they're still going to profit. And a lot of ordinary Americans lost a lot of money.
And that's how the stock markets made headlines. That's all the time we have. But we do thank our panelists, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the British newspaper, The Sunday Times, and Abdelrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas. This program is produced here in Washington by The Voice of America. I'm Dan Raveep.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is host and managing editor of VOA's Daybreak Africa, James Buddy. Our topic, reimagining U.S.-Africa policy under the Biden administration. Our guest, Judd Devermont, director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and that's an important think tank here in Washington. Judd is no stranger to these VOA microphones. He is a regular panelist on our sister debate format program, Encounter. Prior to joining CSIS, Judd Devermont served as the National Intelligence Officer for Africa from 2015 to 2018. In this position, he led the U.S. intelligence community's analytic efforts on sub-Saharan African issues. From 2013 to 2015, he was the Central Intelligence Agency's senior political analyst on sub-Saharan Africa. Judd Devermont also served as the National Security Council Director for Somalia, Nigeria, the Sahel, and the African Union from 2011 to 2013. In this role, he managed the process that resulted in U.S. recognition of the Somali government for the first time since 1991. Judd spent 2 years abroad working at the U.S. Embassy in Abuja, Nigeria from 2008 to 2010. On this edition of Press Conference USA, James Buddy and I will talk with Judd about his recent paper entitled A New U.S. Policy Framework for the African Century. Analysts say that of all the regions in the world, there is more consensus than divergence between Republican and Democratic administrations regarding U.S.-Africa policy. But with the advent of the coronavirus pandemic, which has taken a toll on the continent's economic fortunes, renewed conflict in Ethiopia, backsliding on democratic norms, and the ever-present threat from China's malign influence, there are no shortage of challenges for the Biden administration in Africa. And Judd Devermont joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing. Judd, welcome to Press Conference USA.
Thank you so much, Carol. Thank you, James. I'm delighted to be here.
And I'm always delighted to welcome my colleague, host of the popular Daybreak Africa, James Buddy.
Thank you, Carol. And Judd, it's always nice to be with you.
Judd, in your paper on a new U.S. policy framework for the African century, you say, quote, since the end of the Cold War, most U.S. administrations have promoted democracy and governance, peace and security, trade and investment and development. While these priority areas remain important, their strategic significance to broader U.S. goals has become undervalued. The policy process, including its implementation and communication, has consequently become stale in the purview of lower-ranking officials. Talk about what you mean by that, what you mean also by the African century.
Yeah, thank you so much, Carol. One of the strengths of U.S. policy towards Africa has been the bipartisan consensus that whether it's President Bush or Clinton or Obama, there's been a shared commitment to focusing on the continent, an embrace of a predecessor's programs, and bipartisan support on both sides of the aisle in Congress. And the point in the piece is that that's fantastic. Having continuity is one of the ways in which we ensure that the implementation is solid and long-lasting. But the piece also makes the point that that can be a break on innovation and creativity. So what I say is bipartisan is fantastic. We need more of that. But perhaps we should challenge the consensus just a little bit and challenge some of the conventions, in part because the continent has changed dramatically in the last 25 years. So if it's a consensus based on a continent in amber, you know, from the mid-1990s, then we have to do some rethinking. And I'm happy to elaborate, Carol, a little bit on where I see the continent changing and then where we need to go in terms of policy.
Please go ahead and give us a sense of the direction you think we should be going.
So first, we have to reframe where the continent is today. It is a demographic powerhouse. By 2015, a population of 1.2 billion will double. Nigeria will be the third largest country in the world, surpassing the United States. It's a region with real global sway, both in the UN Security Council and the General Assembly and other bodies. In the Security Council, African countries have three seats, known as the A3. In the General Assembly, with 54 members. It is the largest voting bloc, and it's typically the most unified voting bloc. It's a continent that is committed to democracy in a time when the rest of the world is in democratic recession. Almost 70% of Africans support democracy. Now, that doesn't mean that the supply is where it should be, but the demand remains consistent. And we have seen really a remarkable set of peaceful transitions of power over the last 6 years. Since 2015, there was 33 peaceful transfers of power, and it will be 34 in late February when Niger completes its election cycle. And finally, maybe because of all of those reasons, it's a continent that's attracting a lot of attention from foreign partners. We talk a lot, obviously, about China, but if we broaden the aperture, we see the Gulf states, UAE, Saudi, Qatar, we see Turkey, we see Japan, South Korea, India. I've counted 150 new embassies that have been built on the continent between 2010 and 2015. And I think the last point here before moving to policy recommendations is we have tend to look at what happens in Africa as if it stays in Africa, you know, that it doesn't leave its shores. But if you zoom out, you see that Africa really does change the way the world works. When there was piracy off the Horn of Africa, that changed the maritime industry. The migration crisis in West Africa has really dramatically changed politics in Europe with the rise of xenophobic and ultra-right parties. When the Ebola outbreak happened, that changed the way we thought about global health, at least until the COVID-19 crisis. But we can also make this argument about positive developments. For example, fintech and mobile money, that came out of East Africa, and now that's a global phenomenon. So if you think about the continent and all of these points, demographically, international influence, its commitment to democracy, even if it's in short supply, the fact that so many actors are engaging on the continent, it says that we have to rethink what we do day to day. And so the point of the paper is that there needs to be a new policy framework. And I would just say there's really three overarching principles. First, we have to treat Africans as strategic partners. We have to engage with our African counterparts because there are important issues on the table. It can't be an afterthought. It can't be, well, let's just have another African come to the Oval Office. We have to elevate African voices in global affairs. It is going to be African voices that are going to make the difference on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. It's going to be African voices that are going to be critical in terms of whether or not we can isolate North Korea and the rogue regime's ability to sustain itself through illicit sales. It's going to be African voices that are either going to condemn China's crackdown on democracy protesters in Hong Kong, or they're going to remain silent. So we really do need to think about Africa in this global sense. And then finally, we need to have a real dialogue with Africans about what's happening in our country, what's happening in their country. We need to talk about our failings and our strengths. We need to talk about George Floyd's murder. We need to talk about the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. You know, we have to be not wagging our finger about emulating our model, but rather having a shared dialogue about the challenges we all face. And then one last point that I've done a lot of work on is that we actually have to get outside of the Beltway. And I know VOA is a great example of where many people are listening to this conversation. But too often in Washington, D.C., we talk to each other. And we've done this project called Why Africa Matters to U.S. Cities, where we investigate what the African continent means if you live in Wichita or Boise or Albuquerque or Birmingham. And I think that's really critical because talking about Africa in the traditional Beltway sense about counterterrorism, et cetera, just doesn't resonate with Americans. And so for me, those are some of the biggest sort of framings that I think are critical for our policy. And then I'll bring up some other stuff as we chat.
Sounds great. And also, you certainly defined the African century with all of your points very clearly and vividly. Let me toss it over to James for a question.
Thank you, Kara, and thank you, John, for a beautiful article. For those of us who speak regularly to Africans on the continent, there's no doubt that the Trump administration's America First policy has impacted Africa's view of the United States. Now, while some Africans are still hopeful that the Biden administration can return to what I will call the golden days of U.S.-Africa relations, and as Carol referred to in her opening, some, especially the pessimistic ones, say that Africa is not going to feature prominently in U.S. foreign policy because of shrinking resources brought on by the COVID-19 and the threat to democracy here at home. Can you give our listeners one or two reasons why Africa should be optimistic about U.S.-Africa relations under the Biden administration?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question, James. I think there's a number of things that we are going to see the Biden administration do that is a restoration, as you say, of the golden era. There's a couple of things that I think are going to be moving forward, sort of forward-looking. And then I think there are some questions that you rightly point out about sort of what are the limitations on President Biden's time and attention. But we're going to see a revival of a focus on democracy and governance, which was sorely lacking under the Trump administration. Already, we have seen the State Department and the White House speak out about what's happening in Uganda and Ethiopia. Because the Biden administration is committed to multilateralism, that has important effects for African countries, particularly when you're talking about rejoining the WHO or rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement. And just the fact that they have nominated, and she's in her confirmation process, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who was an ambassador to Liberia and the assistant secretary of state for Africa, I think those are all good signs. President Biden on day one reversed the travel ban. That's a very good news if you're a Nigerian, an Eritrean, a Tanzanian, a Somali, or a Sudanese who had been under that travel ban. And this is a president that is focused on COVID and focused on climate change. Those are all things that I think suggest a positive Africa policy. But that's not just about, as I said, turning the page back to Obama or Bush. You know, what President Biden is talking about is greater engagement with the U.S. diaspora. And you can just see, particularly the number of Nigerian Americans that are in very senior positions in this government, as a good sign. And what I'm thrilled about is that he is committed, at least during the campaign, to do an urbanization project, which for me, this is the big transformation for Africa. And too often, the way that American officials have thought about Africa is rural or agricultural, and that Biden's commitment to think about an urbanization initiative is a really exciting prospect, although I think time will tell what that actually looks like. I do have the same questions that you do, James, about how much time and attention he's going to have, considering this president faces more challenges than anyone starting since the Depression. I think that this president, this is a good thing, actually, is not sure what he's going to do on security engagement. And so we'll have to see how that sort of pans out. And then finally, not clear exactly what the president thinks about some of the Trump initiatives on economics, whether it's the FTA with Kenya, Prosper Africa, the DFC. These were all good things. And even though the Trump administration, I think, has on balance gets an F on Africa policy, the economic programs are important. And I'm waiting to see whether President Biden will commit to those.
On a practical level, although Africa did not feature prominently in the Trump administration, the few times that Africa was featured, a lot was done that some analysts say the Biden administration might have to repair immediately. Let's take the issues of Western Sahara and Morocco's sovereignty and the issue of Jerusalem. What do you think can the Biden administration do?
Well, the easier answer is for Jerusalem, which I believe that Secretary Blinken said that he was not going to reverse that decision. Nine African states, by the way, either abstained or voted in support of the moving of the capital to Jerusalem, but that's a small minority out of 54 countries. But I think that's pretty settled. On Western Sahara, I think time will tell. The decision to recognize Morocco's control, sovereignty over Western Sahara is not going to go down well and has not gone down well with the African Union, where Western Sahara is a member state. Across the continent, it's a little different, though, because Morocco has made a lot of headway with African governments, particularly in West Africa, to recognize its sovereignty over Western Sahara. That has not been the case, particularly in Southern Africa. And so I'm not sure what the Biden administration is going to be able to do with this. They're going to have to think about its relationships with the other countries on the continent, particularly South Africa or Algeria, but also its relationship with Morocco. I should note, by the way, that Israel doesn't recognize Morocco's control over Western Sahara. So that's an interesting wrinkle to think about.
On the longstanding U.S. goals to advance democracy and governance, you make reference to that. What is your recommendation for the Biden administration? How to address the issue of democracy and good governance? Do you think this will be a hard sell given the events of January 6th at Capitol Building here in Washington?
James, I think that the last 4 years under President Trump and the insurrection is an opportunity. It's an opportunity for Americans and U.S. diplomats to talk honestly about our challenges. And I would add here also our own divisions, particularly after the several police killings of African Americans. And so I think that there is a conversation about democracy and governance that can be done quite effectively, where we talk to countries about their challenges and we talk about our challenges and we encourage them to raise questions. We have this series at CSIS called Africa Reacts. We just published our 8th edition where we ask African thought leaders to share their thoughts on the primaries, the inauguration, the election, George Floyd's murder. We had them talk about President Trump's COVID diagnosis. And I think that's the way forward, is a dialogue. But I think that the Biden team has already shown that they're going to talk about democracy and governance, given some of the statements they've made about Uganda, for example. And I think some African governments are not going to be thrilled about that. What I would like to see them do is twofold. First of all, unfortunately, sometimes under previous administrations, we've sort of sorted African countries into good and bad very quickly, right? So a country that is good, Ghana, Senegal, a country that is not so good, Zimbabwe, and those have become sort of static. And I think that what a more accurate conversation would be is to note that all of these countries have strengths and weaknesses, that at the same time that Senegal is a vibrant democracy, President Sall disqualified two of his major candidates in the last election. And we should be able to talk about what's happening in Senegal, regardless of a categorization around the strength of its democracy, because the strength of our democracy has a lot of good and bad. The second thing that I would like to see is President Biden has committed to having a summit for democracy. There's not many details on this yet. I hope to see Africans in a significant role at this event, both African leaders, African civil society, African opposition, and I would like them to not just be compartmentalized to African issues. I want Africans to be engaged on what's happening in Hong Kong. I want Africans to talk about xenophobia in Europe. I want partnerships to come out of that between African and non-African countries on issues of shared concern, perhaps around press freedoms. And I think that's a great first opportunity to reimagine that relationship so it's both global but also local around democracy and governance issues.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Judd Devermont, director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a prominent think tank here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, along with host and managing editor of Daybreak Africa, James Butte. We're discussing prospects for U.S.-Africa policy under the Biden administration. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a very loyal fan, Alhaji Ali Bello from Maiduguri, Borno State in the mighty Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Judd Devermont, director of the Africa Program at CSIS. Judd, we've really enjoyed your conversation so far. I'd like you to make a comment on what the U.S. Congress can do to advance U.S.-Africa policy. We know that foreign policy is usually the province of the executive branch, but now that the Democrats are in control not only of the House of Representatives, but also the Senate, to what extent could that make a difference? That is, you know, this unified government, to what extent could that make a difference in our approach to Africa?
I think it's important, but as we noted earlier, Carol, that there are many Republicans who are committed to Africa and work really well across the aisle on African issues. So I think that having the Democrats in control is important because it means that what happens in the House and the Senate and the White House will work all together. But again, I just don't want to undercut that that's happened in the past when there has been a divided legislature or Republicans, Democrats in different parts of the executive and the legislative branch. But we've got Congressman Meeks, who is now the head of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He's going to be a strong advocate on African issues. We've hosted him now twice to talk about his Africa policy. Senator Menendez will take over the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He has been long engaged on African issues. So I think that's all positive. But what we need to see from Congress is really working with the executive branch to codify executive actions and to bolster budgets. I think that's really important, whether it's Power Africa or AGOA, these initiatives that either started in the executive branch or sort of mutually developed between the two branches, that's what gives them longevity. So that's one thing that I'd like to see Congress do, and I think that will be really positive. The other one is to continue to use its oversight functions, even if you're on the same side, right? Take the Biden team to task, ask hard questions, look at the budget. That's a strength of our democracy, is that the legislative branch will have hearings and review what the executive branch is doing, and then hopefully they collaborate to have a better policy together.
Let's pivot to China, Judd. You say in the paper that African leaders have, quote, deplored what they regard as neglectful, mean-spirited, and China-obsessed U.S. foreign policy. Now, I assume the mean-spirited probably refers to unfortunate choice of words by former President Trump. But talk more about what is perceived as the China obsession. What do they mean by that? What do you mean by that? And how should the United States modify its approach to China's growing influence in Africa?
You know, the Trump administration deserves credit for identifying China as a challenge for U.S. interest. And I share some of their concerns about Chinese investments in technology or in ports or in other critical infrastructure, what that means for both African sovereignty and U.S. interest. But the way that the Trump administration did this meant that they didn't have an Africa policy, they had a China policy. As many analysts like to point out, that when former National Security Advisor John Bolton introduced the Africa strategy, he mentioned China 12 to 14 times, and he didn't mention very few African countries even. Since then, the position that they have put Africans in is to don't choose China, but there isn't really an American alternative in certain sectors. And so it left Africans a little bit in the lurch. They felt like this was a zero-sum proposition. And while they want to work with the U.S., and the U.S., according to polling, is more popular as a model than China is, there really wasn't enough to back it up. So I think under the Biden administration, we will see the U.S. government focus on its strengths and not what it's against when it comes to China. There will be a focus clearly on the strategic threats that China poses. But I also think that they will work to build an U.S. alternative in many sectors, to work multilaterally so that if it's not a U.S. company, perhaps it's a UAE or Turkish or French company. That's particularly important in the infrastructure space. And then I think that they will look for opportunities to cooperate with China when necessary. And this is something that Secretary Blinken said in his confirmation hearings, that China was a strategic adversary, but we need to work with them on limited amounts of issues such as climate change and the COVID-19 response. So in our piece, we talked about constructive competition. How do we compete with China in a way that isn't off-putting to the Africans, that recognizes the Africans' needs, that helps provide tools for Africans to evaluate some of this debt, to do a better job in pushing back on any of the environmental degradation posed by Beijing? And the Africans are doing that. And the African institutions, such as the African Development Bank, has barred several Chinese companies for fraud and corruption. So I think that there's the ability to do this. What I'd like to see from the Africans is being more explicit about what they want in their partnerships, both from us and from the Chinese. What are the levels of transparency, accountability, the standards that they want? And then we can all abide by that. So that's where I think the future is of the China-Africa-U.S. relationship.
Let me turn to my colleague James for another question.
The issue of corruption used to feature prominently in U.S. foreign policy. In fact, I was just reading the 2020 Transparency International Corruption Index, and many African countries did poorly. What do you think the Biden administration can do? Do you think it should return to previous U.S. policy that made corruption a part of the good governance policy?
I do think that they should return corruption to the good governance policy, in part because we know that many Africans are frustrated by the corruption in their societies and how that limits their ability to care for their families and to succeed in their careers. I think there's a couple of things that we have to do. First of all, let's not make this just an African issue. I don't think the Biden team will. And let's recognize that corruption is one of the factors that deters U.S. investment, but not all of the factors. Two, as much as I like Transparency International as an organization, it's not the most methodologically sound approach to measuring corruption. As it says, it's a Perceptions Index. So if there's a big scandal in Angola, Angola next year will move up the scale. So I think we have to work internally on measurements. And then I think that's probably the best place to start is to, this is a global policy. We're going to work to find better ways to indices and to measure this. And then we're going to work with African countries that are interested in it and civil societies to address these issues. And thinking about corruption, not just as an economic problem, but as a governance problem, but also as a security problem. If you look at what's happening in Northeast Nigeria, one of the challenges is the way the Nigerian military asks for bribes, gets contracts that really gums up the ability of humanitarian agencies to access vulnerable populations. So I think we have to have this global perspective and all of the dimensions of what corruption means in terms of inhibiting peace and prosperity on the continent.
And talking about security, conflicts continue to flare up in Africa. We have the conflict in the Tigray region of Ethiopia, conflicts all over. Do you think putting out these fires should be the responsibility of Africa prominently, or there's something that the Biden administration can do to help put out these fires?
Well, I think, James, the responsibility is first and foremost the Africans. And one of the things that I highlight in this piece is just the growth in many of the multilateral organizations on the continent, from the African Union to the G5 Sahel. I think those are all really positive developments. The U.S. government and Africa's international partners can be very helpful here in terms of capacity building. I suspect there'll be a new conversation about U.N. financing of AU peacekeeping missions. That's important. The one thing that the U.S. is very good at and didn't do enough of or at all under the Trump administration is being a convener. And I think the example of what's happening in Tigray, we need to have a global, Africa's partners, those who care about what's happening in the Horn of Africa, need to come together and address what this terrible crisis means for Ethiopians, for the region, for the broader globe, with 100,000 Ethiopian refugees now in Sudan, with more than 1 million displaced people out of Tigray, with Eritrea sending troops into Ethiopia, allegations that Somalis are also fighting, a border flare-up with Sudan. This requires, and I think the U.S. is particularly positioned to do this, to bring everyone together to the table to address access issues for the humanitarian organizations, and also to work towards brokering a peace deal and then holding people accountable for human rights abuses.
The issue of COVID-19 and the vaccine, there's disparity between poor countries and the more wealthy countries. How do you think Africa can handle this issue of the COVID-19 vaccine and making sure that most poor African countries can gain access to this vaccine?
First positive story is that U.S. has rejoined the WHO, which means they'll contribute to COVAX, which is the WHO-supported vaccine. That's good news to begin with. But as you mentioned, James, there is a disparity. And I saw President Ramaphosa of South Africa had just raised this issue. A number of really important people, former leaders such as Ellen Sirleaf Johnson and Mo Ibrahim, the Sudanese business person, have just raised this issue as well, that there is a disparity, that there is hoarding, and this vaccine nationalism is a problem. One of the things, James, that we looked at prior to the vaccine was just on COVID response. We counted 24 countries that are giving support to African countries on COVID-19. So we're talking about PPEs or medicine or ventilators, et cetera. And it wasn't coordinated. It was all done bilaterally. I have a suspicion that it's led to some corruption by different countries, like in Zimbabwe, there was a story about that, in Nigeria. And I think some of the quality wasn't good. Minister Kagwe, the health minister of Kenya, pointed out that the PPEs from Kenya were deficient. And so when we move to vaccines, we have to correct what was wrong about the initial response, which is it was all fragmented and fractured. How do we get together? India's already stepping up and providing vaccines, Mauritius and Seychelles, and then selling it to South Africa. But the U.S. can be a key partner here in terms of having a global conversation to make sure that we address this. As the head of the African WHO has said, either we all are vaccine or none of us are, right? If we either we all get through this or we don't get through this. So I think that's got to be in the back of our mind throughout this process.
Judd Devermont is the director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Judd, thanks so much for sharing your insights and hopes for U.S.-Africa policy going forward.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. And joining me on the program was James Buddy, host and managing editor of Daybreak Africa. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Kelgad.